Roosters be taking practice.
We can only do that by, I don't know what we could do by statute.
So if you're talking about an automobile, he have one half interest in that for his lifetime.
That's right.
Which be far beyond the life.
This is true. And it's conceivable that it might apply to an automobile. It could also apply perhaps to certificates of stuff. He'd be entitled to receive the earnings. What he'd be entitled to as a result of his half ownership of the automobile, I'm not sure.
Why do you say for his lifetime? In reference to personal life?
Because he has a vested interest for his lifetime.
All right. Why don't you just say that he has a half interest in it?
Yeah, that's what we do. A half interest for his lifetime. That's what's vested in him already.
What we're doing is treating this as though he had not survived, whether he does in fact survive. But he's entitled to a half interest for life, because that's what he owns. When he's a joint owner with right of survivorship.
Okay, you'll live that long. Senator Lynch, do you have a question?
Yes. Can you cover somewhere else in here with the situation with the approaches?
No.
It's interesting because we had a case before you in court that's been discussed during this past year. That case, father
runs over a child.
Exactly. Father's exercising his visiting rights, takes the child up to the Columbia, goes out in a boat that he had no business taking out of the river. He's an experienced sailor. Boat capsizes, the little girl is drowned. Father survives. Got an action in the court, which eventually was settled. One of the things to settle on is the guy waiving any claim against his daughter's estate.
We do not have in this draft of code any provision for that kind of situation. It deals only with felonious.
Okay. That takes us through
section 68. Section 69 through 76 are amendments to the Simultaneous Death Act, all of which are made to conform it to the amendments which were made in 1959 to the Uniform Act. We adopted the Uniform Act many years ago. We did not adopt the amendments which were made by the Commissioners on Uniform State Laws in 1959. These amendments are the amendments which they made to their Uniform Code. I don't think they require any particular comment.
Questions on 6976?
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, the amendment on section 70 of the calcite material, that's maybe lost. We've stricken out some stuff from the line 4 to 10, and then added the following.
Where are you looking?
Page 25.
Yes.
Page 25.
Yes. At page 25, the amendment to section 112.020 conforms it to the amendment which was made not in 59, as I said, but in 53, to the Uniform Act. This is the language of the Uniform Act as it now appears. One thing that's rather interesting to me and any interesting committee is on page 26 and lines 21 and 22, in which the amended act expressly provides that where the will makes provision for a presumption as to survivorship, it is effective. And sometimes this is desirable for tax reasons. I think it's probably law in Oregon without this amendment, but I
under federal law, how much of a spread can the testator have in life or in his will if he dies simultaneously? Death results in a year or 6 months?
Six months is the time when the marital deduction is available.
Nothing beyond 6 months.
Nothing beyond 6 months.
Okay.
I think we're at 77 if I'm not going too rapidly.
No.
Please permit me. 77 is a new section. It is similar to section 2801 of the Uniform Probate Code. It permits a renunciation not only of a testamentary gift, but also of intestate succession, and it provides that such a renunciation does not subject the transaction to gift tax.
And what is the reason for that?
A testator leaves Blackacre to his widow and the residuum of his estate to his children. And his widow has other ample provision, and she would just as soon have the children take Blackacre. She may renounce, and the children will take Blackacre without a liability for a gift tax. Now, the same thing can happen upon intestate gift. She may renounce her intestate succession.
Why was 4 months left?
Because that's the period within which contest may be brought and the final account may be filed.
The renunciation cannot be made after the 4 month period without possible liability for a gift tax.
That's correct. We have used a 4 month period wherever a 6 month period is used under our present law. Dower and courtesy abolished, section 78. This, I think, is a very important change in our law. It's already been talked about. We purport to terminate every future protections in full rights of dower, but existing in full rights of dower and courtesy. The only rights which will continue are those which have vested by the death of one of the spouses.
Could I go back to 78 a minute? Not 78, but renunciation. Couldn't that be used as a device to defraud creditors?
I don't see how, because this doesn't take it out of the estate. This simply provides for a different channel of distribution.
Well, let's take the case of a son to whom there is, under the terms of this device, $10,000. Within the 4 months, he renounces that, and he owes everybody in the country. He renounces that, and it goes to his, the only other brother. Creditors could never reach that $10,000.
That's right.
All right, couldn't this be used very handily for that purpose of estate after estate on the part of beneficiaries of the will who happen to be heavily indebted?
Well, I suppose it could be. I think your statement is perhaps overstatement of how general its use might be, but I would say that there could be a case in which a beneficiary would rather that his relative receive the proceeds of the estate than that his creditors receive the proceeds.
You say that the testator would rather?
No, I'd say the beneficiary of the estate could conceivably prefer that a relative receive the proceeds than that his creditors receive the proceeds.
Somehow, if that were to occur, I can see that it would. It could, in every situation, when the client comes to an attorney and someone is, I owe somebody $10,000 and I got $50,000 coming out of this estate, or $10,000, how can I get away from it? Well, make some arrangement here with your brother and renounce your interest in this estate, and they can't touch you. Somehow, to me, that smacks of the invitation to a fraudulent situation in certain circumstances. Now, maybe I'm wrong.
Tony, it is done now under the present code. Furthermore, the testator himself could create a spendthrift trust. This is narrowed to a period of 4 months.
But we're doing it, the testator could do that, realizing the propensities of his children. But we're talking about a period after the death, where an avoiding debtor may wish to escape the just obligation.
For the personal injury case within that 4 month period, for example.
Right.
Same thing is true of a gift to inter vivos. The donee doesn't have to accept a gift.
Well, that's true. But we're just creating another. I'm just bringing it up for discussion.
Is this a possibility where somebody's gone to a bank and say, "Oh, my daddy is 80 years of age or 90 or whatever it is," and heir or I will inherit a whole lot of money when he passes away, get a loan or borrow some money on the street, is that a possibility? And then end up with the bank end up with nothing or somebody end up with nothing?
If a big made a loan on the basis of that forecast, I'd say it serves what it gets.
Well, I think they would take that into consideration.
Did the committee give any thought to adding language to this, to something to the effect that the rights of attaching creditors, execution of judgment creditors, would not be affected by such renunciation?
On the contrary, the last sentence of the section provides expressly that the creditors will be affected.
Yeah, my question is, did they give any thought to changing that?
Yes, yes they did.
And this is your conclusion?
Yes.
All right, I won't belabor the matter any further. You have no right to change it in a testate situation anyway. And this certainly puts the intestate situation in the same category.
The principal change that this makes are two changes that are made by this section. One of them is that it applies to intestate succession as well as to gift by will. And the other is that it clarifies the problem of gift tax liability. It's clear that it's free from gift tax under this section. It is not clear under present law.
Is this sufficient to knock out the tax lien and the federal government act?
I think the federal government would recognize the effect of state law, but I'm not sure.
Well, they do with respect to descent and distribution, and there's no reason why they should not recognize this. This is simply a limitation on that purpose.
Okay.
80. 80, special administrators. This is the section we referred to a little while ago, in which I said the section defined the circumstances under which a special administrator might be appointed and his powers and duties. The purpose of a special administration is, of course, to take care of an emergency pending the appointment of a personal representative. Special administrators are excluded from the definition of personal representatives. They have limited powers. They receive compensation for their special services. Their attorney receives a fee for his services. When they get through with taking care of the emergency, they turn over whatever they have in their possession to the administrator or executive, and he goes on from there. There is nothing very important or surprising about Section 80. There's an important change in Section 81 on venue. You are well aware that if a testator lives in Washington County and has all his business relations in Multnomah County, he must go to Washington County to probate estate under present law. We provide very broadly for the administration of estates in any of three or four counties, depending on how you want to count them. In the county where the decedent had his domicile, which is his permanent place of abode, or where he had his place of abode at the time of his death, there too, right there. In the county in which the property of the decedent, where property of the decedent was located at the time of his death, or is located at the time the proceeding is commenced, or C, in the county in which the decedent died. And then, just to make dead sure that we don't make any blunder here, we add that filing a proceeding in the wrong county does not constitute a jurisdictional defect. So you can start a probate proceeding in any county, and it will not affect the jurisdiction of the court to make appropriate orders.
Why make it so broad?
The feeling of the committee was that if we allow a probate proceeding to be brought where it is convenient to the parties, that we have served the interests of the state in doing so. We don't think that there's any merit in saying that we must go to Washington County to probate the estate of a Multnomah County businessman simply because he lives there. So if he has property in Multnomah County, consisting perhaps of securities in a safe deposit box, that gives Multnomah County the proper venue for such a proceeding, and we would expect to have a good many Clackamas and Washington County residents whose estates would be probated in Multnomah County, because it's more convenient for everybody.
I'll tell you this, but I'm going to file those petitions fast.
Mm-hmm. That's all right. That's all right.
I might point out, too, with respect to personal injury lawsuits, there have been some recent Supreme Court cases which deny that it's substantively right because the probate was commenced in Toronto County and the statute of limitations of it being removed. This would eliminate that possibility.
Yeah. Why do you read it?
Two more beautiful bills that were into this somehow. 237
and 266. Lundy.
All right,
pardon.
All right. Section 82 deals with the situation which arises when county gets there first. If the proceeding seeking the appointment of personal representative of some the same estate or proceedings to probate a will of the same decedent are commenced in more than one county, they shall be stayed except the county where first commenced until final determination there of venue. A proceeding is considered commenced by the filing of a petition. In determining the venue, the court, if the court finds a transfer to another county where a proceeding has been commenced is for the best interest of the state, it may, in its discretion, order such a transfer. And then it goes on in subsection 2 to provide how the transfer shall be effected by filing a transcript of the proceedings in the county from which it is transferred, with the county clerk of the county to which it is transferred. Any comment there? This is not altogether new. It provides some of the same language as is now contained in section 109.345 and 126.416 relating to the trade.
'83
outlines in a good deal of detail what is to be included in a petition for the appointment of a personal representative and a probate of a will.
Well, Cliff, in relation to that, I suppose that the information you didn't have available initially would be furnished later. Because how many times has your bank probated wills where you didn't know the ages of the minors or...
petition shall include the following information so far as known.
So far as known.
Information of his sheets. If you have an intestate death and no known heirs, you deliver or mail to the director of the Division of State Lands a copy of the petition. This is quite a bit different from the present law, which requires that you shan't make any disposition of the assets of the estate of a value greater than $100 without serving him with 10 days' notice of your application for leave to do so. We say he's entitled to notice that the proceedings are started. And from there on, he does the same as anybody else who's a party in interest. And incidentally, these provisions have received approval from the Division of Lands.
Is that the name of the Division of State Lands?
Yes, that's the present name of it. We have to get used to a lot of new names, such as personal representatives.
In order to get away from this idea of having to change this organization, if you only have a certain under governor, it's very easy to have someone to channel this right to the right person. Or not apt under any constitutional division to get rid of the office of governor.
Right.
And we're not apt to do it under statute, as our present constitution. And all I'm getting at is we're going to be running into this thing that these reorganizations and changes of name. If we just made it right to the top and served on the governor, what do you think of that, Bob? You could easily have it.
It's a real problem.
We're all the time going in some act we passed saying the legislative council is authorized to go through the whole damn ORS and change the names wherever he finds it.
Some officers you can describe as sort of American, right? They call one of the constitutional
looks like it's Senator Lamp. You keep changing the names of these divisions, the departments, the branches all the time. But this is the name as of today.
This is the name.
This is the correct name, and it's relatively new, and I don't think it's likely to be changed in the next batch.
Well, we can always have somebody introduce a shocking bill to change the name here.
There are a number of references to the Board of Control.
References to the Board of Control?
I think both of these things aren't as difficult to handle as they used to be. You know, I use that device of legislature declaring the name of the chain. But the legislature declaring that, then we can go ahead and do a tutorial and change those names.
E5.
Upon an ex parte hearing of a petition for the probate of the will, an affidavit of an attesting witness may be used instead of the personal appearance of the witness in the court. The witness may give evidence of the execution of the will by attaching his affidavit to the will or to a photographic or other facsimile copy of the will, and may identify the signature of the testator as witnesses to the will by the use of the will or the copy. The affidavit shall be received in evidence by the court and shall have the same weight as the matters contained in the affidavit, as if the testimony were given by the witness in open court. The affidavit of the attesting witness may be made at the time of the execution of the will or at any time thereafter.
That's going to be a saving.
It's a good one.
This was a suggestion of a man who has never probated a will.
I think that's a very good thing
to set up.
Some of them are, some people have already done it.
This is true. Under existing law.
Yeah.
However, upon the motion of any person interested in the estate, filed within 30 days after the order admitting the will to probate is made, the court may require that the witnesses making the affidavit be brought before the court. If the witness is outside the reach of a subpoena, the court may order that the deposition of the witness be taken in the manner provided by ORS Chapter 45. If evidence of none of the attesting witnesses is available, the court may allow proof of the will by testimony or other evidence that the signature of the testator or at least one of the witnesses is genuine. This is a slight departure from present law. In the event of the contest of the will or probate thereof in solemn form, proof of any fact shall be made in the same manner as in the suit and affidavit is a codification existing. Any questions or comment?
86.
Subsection 3 of the real government.
Subsection 3 of 86.
Of 85.
Of 85, okay. Establishing foreign wills. A written will of a testator who died domiciled outside this state upon probate may operate upon property in this state may be admitted to probate upon petition, therefore, by filing a certified copy of the will and a certified copy of the order admitting the will to probate or evidencing its establishment in the jurisdiction where the testator died domiciled. A will offered for probate under this section may be contested for a cause which would be ground for rejection of a will of a testator who died domiciled in this state. This is taken in part from the Uniform Probate of Foreign Wills Act, which is considerably more generous than the committee was in the admission of foreign wills.
I don't understand. That is a domicile in State X. He has his will there, which is all of the laws of State X, but some property in the state of Oregon is affected. And his will is filed for probate, admitted to probate in State X. Mm-hmm. Now, the subsection 2 doesn't mean that reaches to State X and requires some unattested witness. It doesn't mean that Oregon protects that.
No, because we have already provided that if the will is executed in the manner required by the law of the state where the testator is domiciled, it satisfies our requirements for execution.
That's the ordinary rule. Now, that's in here?
That's in the section on how wills may be executed.
Right.
It's not in this section, but...
I don't think there's any ambiguity out here.
No.
It says, may be contested for a cause which would be grounds for rejection of a will of a testator who died domicile to the state.
We're going to give you some grounds for rejection, right?
No, I don't recall that we do. We provide in the next section for a contest, but we don't provide for grounds for contest, do we?
I think what you're aiming at is sub 2 of 86, of course, is such things as fraud, duress, and something like that. But you're not just aiming at
incompetency. The fact that the testator is competent is a question which has been settled in the state in which the will was offered and received in probate. But that does not preclude us from raising that question here in a contest proceeding.
It wouldn't add anything, wouldn't verify anything by adding unless otherwise it is fully provided.
I don't think
I see what his, I don't think so either. I think that it's probably adequate.
Mr. Chairman, may I make a comment on this point? Thinking committee was this. You have a man who died leaving property in Texas. None of the family live in Texas or have ever lived in Texas. You may have grounds in the knowledge of the family in Portland or Oregon, fairly conclusive on the question of either incompetency or undue influence. In Texas, because it's gotten the property, somebody has gone ahead, a creditor or some other party, relative, or probated that will in Texas, and by the time the people in Portland know about it with these just grounds, this thing has gone through the mill down there. Now, this is to allow the local people who know these circumstances to have the same right to contest this will as if it hadn't been started somewhere else. I think that
I remember a uniform building in one of those that contemplates that these circumstances which were necessarily passed upon as a state of council will be accepted in Oregon as though there had been an adjudication here. And although there was a division of opinion on the committee, the majority of the committee were of the opinion that we ought to be able to try those questions here if we were going to admit the will to probate here. And so if the question arises whether there was duress or incompetency, and the will should not be admitted here because those are grounds for contest, they may be contested here, notwithstanding the fact that there was an adjudication in the state of domicile that the testator was competent and there was no duress. This is a policy question, and this is the conclusion that the committee reached up. The next section, 87, is like our present statute on contest, except that it shortens the time from 6 months to 4 months. The provision for the selection of personal representatives in section 88 provides for preference in the following order to the executor named in the will, to the surviving spouse, or his nominee, which is an interesting departure from the present law, to the nearest of kin of the deceased, or his nominee. And then we get into the escheat situation, to the director of the division of lands. If it appears that the decedent died wholly intestate, he may be appointed personal representative of that will. And last, of course, to any other person. These represent some departures from our present law, and I think advantageous, desirable departures. Any comment or question? In 89, we deal with persons who are not qualified under our present law and under this proposed act. The qualifications of a personal representative are stated only in a negative fashion, persons who are not qualified. And this adds to the persons who are not qualified in sections 4, 5, and 6, and 7. A felon or a judge who's not qualified.
Same category.
voluntary manslaughter. And yet, what, the guy's not a dishonest person, he's a guy who got real excited and killed somebody.
There's a further ramification of this. Some states have statutes which provide for full restoration of a felon's civil rights and expungement from the record of the conviction after a certain number of years. California, Nevada, both have those laws. What if we enact such a law that provides, you know, after 10 years upon application, we'll have it expunged from the record?
Was convicted in California, the time expired, and he's here, it's expunged, but somebody knows about it. Contests his right to be appointed person representative on the ground that, in fact, he was convicted of felony in California 23 years ago. I don't know, that maybe it's not important, but it just seems to me that.
I should say this, Senator Lance. This law, in that respect, follows exactly the language of our present law. Section 115.410 provides that the following persons are not qualified to act as executive or administrators. And the third category is persons who have been convicted of any felony.
What about a person who you don't list here, but points for someone who's interested in being able to be and convince the court? Just that's part of the not do or do, but the person is solely absolutely unfit. He may not be a convicted felon, he may not be a disbarred lawyer, he may not be a judge, he may not be an incompetent or a minor, but his general course of dealing is such that the court doesn't want to trust him.
Let me go back to Section 88. Upon the filing of the petition, if there is no will, or if there is a will and it has been proved, the court shall appoint a qualified person to get fined suitable.
Him upon the mere petition being filed to begin with.
No, it appoints a qualified person to find suitable.
Now, supposing there's no contest until after the appointment, which is a pretty routine thing when somebody comes up with a petition.
And,
well, how do you get rid of that? He says right away, the guy rushes in there, the oldest son, they'll say, one parent, right? And the rest of the kids all know it. He's no good. He can point to the fact that he gambles, can't manage his own property rights, and so forth. Well, I'd rather have
the court can require
the average bear.
The court can require whatever bond it deems necessary, and unless it can post that bond, he can't qualify. I think this can be disposed of in present law and under this proposed code.
We'll probably be making changes in the next few years with respect to our attitude toward felons and those convicted of misdemeanors involving moral turpitude that are changing constantly. And I don't know whether we at this time could introduce a new philosophy with respect to these people in this particular code, but I'm sure that it won't be long before we will be tinkering with this in a couple of years.
I think that's quite possible, and I don't mean to say that I would strenuously resist any change presently. I am calling attention, however, to the fact that this simply preserves existing
law. The only trouble is that the legislative history of this act will appear quite rather sad if we delete that. This time, when they read the record, they said, well, felons are invited to be.
Inasmuch as you did follow the present law, was there any specific reason why you excluded misdemeanors involving moral turpitude?
I'm sure that was discussed, and I don't remember what the discussion was. I'm sorry.
Well,
I know we went into a rather extended discussion of these categories under the present law, and we booted that out, and I don't remember what the discussion was.
Well, I can tell you the result of the discussion was the insertion of the words, if fine suitable. I pointed out several instances where the court should be given discretion to reject the request for the appointment of a particular person whom the court knew to be unfit, example, someone who dipped into another estate and stole the money and has been prosecuted for. And on the basis of that situation, we felt the words "it finds suitable" would authorize the court to reject the request for the appointment of such a person, and that would include it. One guilty of a misdemeanor that were of sufficient consequence to his integrity and performance of his duties.
So,
yes, that's right.
This other way, what you do is you come to the same this argument is that if this thing is made to appear, then your only remedy apparently is to raise the bond, and what you're saying is surety comes in and get a veto and decide who will be administrators in this state.
Who's the raising the bond? What level?
No, it would be the raising the bond. What was your amendment?
You have this. Somebody comes in a routine situation, hands a petition to be appointed, and the person represented. You don't know the person who's been convicted about misdemeanor, felony, or a perpetuity. All it appears to your knowledge is that Roma Lone County is a big county, population-wise. So you don't know the person. Nobody has any personal knowledge at this point. You pass as you usually with the petition being there and the $1,000 bond or whatever necessary, whatever you set. And you would appoint. Person gets it, it's only later that you find out that you've been convicted of misdemeanor involved in the
tomorrow. Well, let's talk specifically about a case where that occurred. It was a felony, however, instead of a misdemeanor. Over here in the section regarding removal, we did then refer to the removal person, not qualified person, section 99.
Okay, that's what I was asking originally, just where is the provision of taking care of? What's that for?
The reason I changed it. Misdemeanor to felony is because the example I had is a felony in the present moment.
Oh, in 99. Okay, except let's go to the next lesson.
Now, I want to stop for a minute on sub 6 of section 89 and call attention to the fact that we are providing that a testator may name in his will an executor who is not a resident of the state of Oregon, and he will qualify for appointment by appointing a resident agent who is a member of the Oregon Bar.
To accept service, son.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Why didn't you go all the way and permit a non-resident to be an administrator as well?
Bert Butler was on the committee. And we had some sharp differences of opinion within the committee as to whether there should be any qualification at all of a non-resident, and if so, whether there should be a qualification of a non-resident executor only, or a non-resident executor or administrator.
Well, if he appoints a member of the Oregon State Bar, it can be served. What is the difference? We do it in guardianship.
I'm not the best man to argue in favor of this distinction.
Would you ask Mr. Butler to defend his position?
You want to talk about it, Bert?
Well, I think that the my view is testator has named non-resident to serve as executor. Usually that person is going to be one who probably is going to inherit the estate taken in the will. Of course, the administrator would also, but it seems to me that the other members that there is a distance between appointing someone to act for the settlement of an estate here, who not appointed by the testator, but who qualifies simply by reason of relationship or no other reason, without the benefit of professional qualification.
Supposing a father living in Oregon has one child, a widower, living in Idaho, the only heir, dies intestate, just as qualified as anyone in Oregon, if he were to appoint an Oregon member of the bar here for service, why should he be treated differently than if his father had executed a will and to designate this fellow, his son in Idaho, as an executor?
In your example, I think this son a resident of New Jersey or Tennessee, where you have Ontario on one side and Rupin on the other, I think you have a different situation.
Well, let's say within 500 miles then.
I may say, Mr. Chairman, that our committee had several meetings at which this question was reviewed, and we took at least three different positions at different times and wound up with this as our final result.
At one time we had no restriction on it at all, did we?
That's right, and another time we had absolutely a non-resident is disqualified by non-residents. We wound up with this...
compromise?
Well, it was a position which we could all accept.
All right.
The words named executor in the will will then with that person qualified.
Yeah. Section 90.
The necessity and amount of the bond. This provides that the bond. Shall be executed by a surety company. Or in personal record, personal security and resident of this state in an amount fixed by the court. Where is that? The amount of the bond shall be adequate to protect interested persons, but in no event shall it be less than $1,000. In setting the amount of the bond, and this is quite a departure from our present law, which, as you recall, contemplates that the bond shall be in the amount of the value of the personal property and the annual income from the real property. We say that the court has broad authority to fix it in view of the nature, liquidity, and apparent value of the assets of the estate, and anticipated income during administration, probable indebtedness, and taxes. No bond is required of a corporate trust company in the present law. This can change that. In this connection, look also at section 129.2c. At page 48, on to the personal representative. This requires that when a sale is made, there must be an additional bond filed unless the court orders otherwise in the amount of the proceeds of the sale. This is kind of an interesting approach, I think, a backward approach to further exigence. We do not require extended proceedings to authorize the sale. But we do require that an additional bond be posted unless the court orders otherwise.
Well, and I suppose that you could submit to the court the circumstances under which the sale is going to be made, to whom the money is going to be paid, et cetera, et cetera, and aid the court in determining whether or not the bond will be required. Right. So, there's a flexibility there.
Can you provide in the will, or you provide in the will that the executor need not file a bond and have that apply to the second bond over here?
The court has a right to initially require a bond whether the will makes provision for no bond or not.
That's right, but if the court does not require a bond,
in the first instance,
it is not required by 2C on page 48. This applies when a bond has been required.
So if the court initially is not required a bond, it's not incumbent upon the executor to make application for a dispensation.
That's right. Unless the court has required a bond notwithstanding that provision in the will in the first instance.
In that situation, the court has required no bond initially, and the personal representative wants to sell some property. He notifies the court. Can the court at that point say, I require you to furnish a bond as personal representative, and also, now since this has come to my attention, I require you to furnish a bond before you sell this property? Court can do that at any time in the proceedings, can he not?
I think so.
So the net effect of it is that when that comes to the court's attention, that you can, in the second situation on the sale of property, bring about the fact that a bond will be furnished. Isn't that accurate?
I think that is. Okay. Section 91 provides for increasing, reducing, or requiring a new bond. This is not a material departure from existing law. Letters testamentary or of administration, section 92. We have so much letters of administration that we've made one rather important addition, I think, by providing this certifies that the will of blank deceased has been approved and has been, and blank has been appointed, and is or are at the date hereof the duly appointed qualified and acting executors of the will, and so forth. This provision that the letters, that the letters testamentary or of administration shall certify that at the date of the certificate, the personal representative is the duly appointed, qualified, and active personal representative, is new, and I think it's good. Section 93. Designation of attorney to be filed. The personal representative has employed an attorney to represent him in the administration of the estate, he shall file in the estate proceeding the name and post office address of the attorney, unless that information appears in the petition or the order appointing the personal representative. This is practice in Multnomah County, I think it is in most other counties. Information to heirs and devotees. Now here is an interesting departure from existing law. We are required under this code to mail heirs and devisees. The information is listed in this section. We are also required under the next section to publish notice of showing the information. And that notice is directed not only to creditors but to interested persons.
How do you define it?
We look back to the
definition. It is defined in the definition.
Anyone
else who cares? Another German. Hey, I'm curious, so I might be away from the memo 63 that required sending a copy of the will.
Yes, we got away from that because we thought it was not serving a useful purpose.
It seems to me that the most interesting thing is to someone who is a prospective heir that the state is a will and a confident will, rather than the fact that a will is a will.
All right, if you require a copy of the will and a copy of the inventory to be given to every beneficiary of the will or every potential contestant, you're going to require a lot of expense. And what are you going to accomplish really? We didn't think we'd accomplish very much. We notify, we send copies of the will to people who have been given a small pecuniary gift. They don't benefit by getting all the rest of the will, but that's what we have to do now. We do,
sure, the requirements here don't require any notification to the prospective heir as to what share of the estate he will take, whether his name is nominal.
But it gives him the name and address of personal representative and of his attorney. He has the information about who can be the person of whom he should make inquiry. So anything he wants to know, he gives him the date and the appointment, the date of the appointment. He gives him the place and the date of death, whether the will has been, whether a will has been admitted to probate.
I just have to talk about it. Just a comment. We're shortening the time to 4 months for the contest. And apparently shortening the time to 4 months for the closing of the estate. Shortening the period of publication before and after. If you got the after yet, I assume it's consistent with the what is dangerous to prison. It seems to me that we should probably send a copy of the will out, more importantly, because of the short amount of time.
Well, the committee thought that this was not serving a useful purpose and it should be abandoned. Now, you get the last word on that.
Mr. Chairman, may I...
After the sentence through, isn't there?
Yeah. May I make a comment? Since that amendment was put through the legislature, I think, and of course, in my own experience, I come more in contact with people who deal in this kind of thing than in other types of practice. And I think the practical objections I've heard from these people on this matter of having to send out wills, which in large estates very often may be lengthy, and the list of legatees for relatively small amounts in some of these large estates is tremendous. And the reaction I get from attorneys who specialize in probate practice is that when they send a copy of the will to somebody in a very large estate with a great many substantial beneficiaries, and then they come in for $50 or $100, it stirs up a mare's nest. And personally, I've heard many objections to that amendment when it went through this legislature.
My comment would be twofold. The first is that I don't think we should write the code for the very large estate, because numerically the smaller estate is far more prevalent. Secondly, I think that we shouldn't be afraid of stirring up points next, because they should be stirred up at this point rather than later on.
I think the some
marriage. Mr. Chairman, under this provision, under the will, the situation is only whether the will were the people that notes. Under this situation, all the legatees and deputies and let's see, everybody gets notice under this.
Those who are disinherited as well as those who were beneficiaries of the will. Now, I think of a will which I probated not so very long ago, in which there were about 30 beneficiaries, or perhaps not quite that many. The testate Griggs had divided her estate into fractions, and she gave 10% of her estate in equal shares to three people, and just things as that. Now, the will itself was mailed, or a copy of the will was mailed to each of those 25 or 30 beneficiaries, and they had not the faintest idea whether they were getting anything or nothing, because they were getting 10% of an unknown, or a third of 10% of an unknown. All right, now you mail them a copy of the inventory. This doesn't help because they don't know what debts they are to pay. They don't know what they're going to get unless they
that
ask questions of somebody
up
who can answer them.
In December, we sent out copies of a will that was about 20 pages long to 98 different people designated in that will. No little, sometimes is a $50, $100. Did you say, though, they knew?
He had to hire two extra lawyers in his law firm.
And the estate wasn't the big one.
Committee in connection with sections 94 and 95 gave any consideration to having an effect sort of a ministerial duty here formed by the clerk of the court rather than by the attorney or person who represents.
It was a feeling of the committee that a question about the estate ought to be directed to the personal representative or his attorney. The clerk of the court doesn't have the information to answer sensible questions.
I'm not going to just say the actual ministerial duty of mailing out this information. Still, the things to be shown would be the ones that are shown here.
Well, from the county clerk's point of view, that would be an extremely expensive situation. It costs a lot more public funds, and there's no particular reason why the public should pay for it rather than the estate. Okay, I think that's the real answer.
That's what the sort of tax on the estate is less amount of the attorney fees time, attorney's time fees for that time.
But the feeling is that the estate should bear that expense rather than the public general, which would be the case of the county clerk.
And the attorney should be the one responsible to see that it goes out and knows when it goes out. Now, if the county clerk mails it out, may go out later.
I think he's going to have a keener.
Sorry, go out earlier.
He's going to have a keener interest in it, I think. I don't think this whole thing is that important, except the question that Dave raised about whether a copy of the will should be sent to you.
Well, this was a subject.
You apparently made that decision based upon all of your study and your hearings. I haven't found it that it contributed a great deal.
When you mailed out copies of your will to 97 beneficiaries, how many inquiries did you get back from?
I don't remember getting any.
Yeah. This is typical, isn't it?
Suppose you do say that's the requirement here, then you don't go any further. What's the effect of someone knowingly and willfully violating?
I don't know. What is the effect today?
Well, you've got some curative phrases all through this thing. It's not jurisdictional. It's cause for removal, but not spraying.
Well, that would be dereliction of duty and cause for removal, but that doesn't invalidate the will. It doesn't go to the basic question of whether or not the will is valid. I might say that I...
First representative cause notice to be published in the notice. The breach of his duty to the person's concern, but does not affect the validity of his appointment with power, duties of power, other side. Put that right in there.
I entertained initially, years ago, the same view that you do. Over the years, I've been talked out of it, convinced now that it would be improper to send the well out of your basis.
Why not easy to get pushed over the center of all the rules?
Well, I was very convinced. The committee will tell you that.
I resent that. I think the Senate gets pushed around by the House all the time.
That's the goal of the canvas backs, if you ask me.
All right, that's something that maybe we can think about. Go to 95. I have a question on
this
that.
Requires publication of notice to interested persons. And it spells out in detail what facts are to appear in published notice.
Would this hurt anything if we provide for 3 consecutive weeks?
Oh, no.
sort of a compromise for many of the...
Yeah, Bill.
No, there's no objection.
Three might be a little bit more. 3 publications or 2 now?
No, this is, the way this is written now, it means 2 publications. If we make it read 3, it will mean 3 publications.
I so move.
What? I didn't hear your motion.
Was your motion that you change it to 3? On line 23, page 34, change the word 2 to 3. Will be 3 consecutive weeks.
Well,
this
is Chairman,
Ontario Arc is prompted that really bad.
Senator Hudson, Jefferson, I got my first letter today from one of the newspapers. We got about
several.
We thought we were putting up many. I got so far we're putting up more.
It should be 3 all the way through.
Okay. All those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion's carried.
And now, Mr. Chairman, would it be the agreement of the committee that since we made the change from 2 to 3 here, that we should make the other notices conform?
What notice do you have reference to?
There isn't public notice of final tax.
There isn't any? And we don't have to bother with that.
What sales of property?
There is no public notice of sales of property.
I think we ought to make this more than it. Thank you very much.
You can always say you help.
There may be some cases in which there will be published notice under the general provision for giving notice. And
Yeah, section 13 calls for two consecutive weeks. On page 9, line 20, the same amendments could well be made for the sake of uniformity.
What line on page 9?
Line 20, page, line 20, page 9.
I so move, Mr. Chairman.
You've heard the motion. Line 20, page line, page 2 to 3.
I didn't plan to oppose this motion by having the expertise of the down committee.
Well, that being the case, all in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Judge Dixon, you can see that we aren't entirely oblivious of the pressure and criticism from the outside, especially the newspapers. That's the only comment I'll make. 96.
Inventory, we no longer require filing within 30 days. We've extended it to 60. And we no longer require an appraisal as a matter of routine. We provide for estimates of the value by the personal representative where there is no purpose in having an appraisal.
And, Chairman, when you appeared before us initially to give us the overview on this, I asked the question of whether or not the inheritance tax department would accept these appraisals. And I wonder if your committee is in a position to answer that. I'm particularly concerned about what fiscal impact it might have on them if they wouldn't accept the budget, accept the appraisals.
Well, they're not going to accept these appraisals any more than they do today.
Don't will have any effect at all.
No.
The appraisals will have an effect. The personal representative can just as well set down the value of listed stocks as a court-appointed appraiser can set it down. But when it comes to a question of putting a value upon Black Acre, it may very well be that the personal representative doesn't feel able to get a fair value. So he employs an appraiser, pays him an appraiser fee.
No
His appraisal, the appraiser's appraisal, will then be accepted or rejected by the state treasurer, just as it would be if it were a court appraiser. But there won't be any court appraisers ordinarily. There will be appraisals of only such part of the estate as requires appraisal, and those would be by such appraisers as the personal representative selects.
And the state treasurer's office going to look to the competency of the engaged appraiser.
If you've got some diamond rings to
this
appraise,
this is one good thing.
And you have Blackacre to appraise, you don't have the same person appraise both.
And not only that, Mr. Chairman, the state tax commission are waiting for you down the road to be under appraised property.
Oh, yes, that's true enough.
It would cap the game, so.
No, I should say the answer to your question, Senator, is that we have no assurance the state treasurer will accept anybody's appraisal. We do not now have that assurance.
I'm sure that, that today, state treasurer's office, that when Mr. Furter looks at the inventory and appraisal, and he sees that three people have been appointed by the court, and particularly if they come in the same community, he's soon going to know, here are the same three old birds again praising this, and they've always been low in the past. So he says, Mr. Uturi, I'm sorry, but how did these people arrive at these figures? When the assessor says that the true cash value is $18,000 more than your appraisers have fixed, I think this will help things a great deal.
Well, it'll cut down on it, but as provided in 98, the personal representative may employ a qualified appraiser, but he need not. He could put the value on Blackacre himself.
He could, yes.
Put it on his $1.
Does that give you any qualms, Judge Dixon, about that?
Because the assessor has already fixed the value. I think Senator Turi has said that the state treasurer would probably have to check anyway, and certainly he would inquire if there was a substantial variance between the assessor's figure and the figure supplied by the personal representative.
And then the senator husband has suggested that if those fellows don't do it right, the income tax collector is going to be interested because he's the one who collects his tax in the event it's sold for more than it's appraised for later on.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's one other significant fact here. Under our present code, the court has the responsibility for determining the tax. Under this code, the state treasurer has the responsibility, so it's shifting the burden.
As a matter of fact, Mr. Chairman, the courts generally go along with their determination of returning the sale of paying the cash bill. The first person to pay any cash bill is Mr. Berger and the debtor.
Now they, in most of the cases, make that determination now.
Well, anyway, we will not go before the court for determination of taxes unless and until there is a dispute under this code.
Mr. Chairman, it wasn't mentioned that subsection 2 gives the court the power in every case to require an appraisal. Whether the personal representative does or doesn't, the court can always come in and order the property.
I think, as a matter of fact, that would be an unusual circumstance.
Unless somebody were beating about the price of the property or something of that sort.
Now, Section 97 provides for supplementing the inventory when additional property is discovered. Section 98, we've already been discussing about the selection of appraisers.
Chairman, I have two mechanical questions. Sub 3 provides each appraisal shall be in writing and shall be signed by the appraiser making it. With the present practice of having the appraiser sign an inventory, it would be sufficient.
It would be sufficient, although it would be unusual, I think, because we're not talking about having all of the estate appraised in the ordinary case. I can't see any particular gain by having an appraiser put a value on the securities, which are listed securities.
Well, then we'll be talking about the appraiser's filing a separate affidavit. He has appraised certain property, has found that he values his opinion to be X number of dollars.
Yes, he would make a certificate, which would be filed.
There would not then be signing the actual inventory itself.
No.
As the present case.
Not ordinarily, I would think.
Second question, sub 4, again, mechanical. Is there any place in the proposed code which sets forth a reasonable fee for the appraisal?
There is not. We decided that we didn't approve of a statutory fee for appraisals.
These would be fees approved by the court?
The final account will be approved by the court. Any expense incurred by the personal representative is a credit on his final account, if it is justified. If the court finds that the expense was not justified, it will be disallowed as a credit.
Mr. Chairman, may I say for the benefit of the representative, this was brought up in the earlier hearing, but the general setup we have for the appraisal follows almost identically the suggestion and recommendation we had from the National Association of Property Appraisers. This is the way that they want to have this thing handled as we received it on a fee basis.
I should like to make it clear, however, that we are not doing this because they recommend it. We're doing it because we think it's proper.
This brings up another question as well. Are we really stuck for a fee appraisal price on going out and appraising a piece of real property? Are we talking about $150 to $200 that you have in a condemnation case for MIA appraisers to go out and take a shot? This is one
you
thing
could
about
be,
appraisal
if
schedule.
It was disputed, that situation could arise. On the other hand, you could have a situation where you have a 100-acre tract of land here, and you could get somebody next door to make an appraisal of that by going down to the assessor's office and finding out what the true cash value is, what adjacent property sold for, which wouldn't be any time-consuming task, and he'd arrive at a figure of $2,000 an acre, whereas perhaps the true cash value was $1,800, or he could be low. But you might have diamond rings or something that you really want somebody, or antiques. And in that case, you may have to engage the service of someone knowledgeable in that particular area. this has a flexibility to it that fits almost any situation as I see it.
So flexibility to get a executor and a...
What are you saying, Dave?
I says a flexibility to get an executor to buy informants later when he files his final accounting and finds out that the fee paid to MIA appraiser was three times that which he could obtain by using.
Well, if he wants to be careful about it, I imagine the thing for him to do is to file a petition with that court and say that he's, there's nothing in here to prohibit this, and
I'm
say that they're asking for $300 for this and obtain court approval.
The executor or any party in interest may go to the court at any time for instructions. Or the
deed.
Yeah.
Most often.
Are we ready for 99?
Right.
I don't mean to correct this on your time, sir.
No.
We'll finish this article.
Shall, yes, that's what I thought.
This is taken from Wisconsin, section on removal of a personal representative. And it's just what you would expect it to, should be. We do not have a very similar statute now. Section 102 that provides for the notice. In Section 102, we provide that upon the appointment of a successor, personal representative, notice of his appointment shall be given. The republished notice shall state that the original representative died, was removed, or resigned, and show the date of death or resignation and the date of appointment of the new personal representative. Period of time between the death, removal, or resignation and the date of first republication of notice shall be added to the period required for presentation of claims by the original notice. So when you have a 4 month period under the original notice and there is a death of the administrator and a successor is appointed, that 4 months may be extended by the amount of the interval.
That could be as much as almost 4 months.
Yes, it could be. And if the notice first given, it provides for presentment of claims to the administrator, and he dies after 1 month. And then nothing happens for another 4 months. Mm-hmm. So there's nobody to whom you can present a claim. But when the successor administrator is appointed, he publishes notice of his appointment, and the interval between the death of the first administrator and the appointment of the administrator de bonis known is added to the original 4 month period.
That's a good provision.
I think it is.
Yeah.
Won't happen very often.
And then finally, sub 3, no notice by the successor personal representative shall be required if the period for filing claims expired prior to the death or resignation or removal of the original personal representative. And that period is done through Article 3 and through Section 102, and I'm tired and I think you are too.
All right, and Wednesday at 1 o'clock then we'll resume with Section 103.
May I express appreciation for your patience?
Well, we express appreciation of these people.
I certainly do want to thank each and every one of you because this is moving along nicely and making progress. Thank you very, very much.
I mentioned that on Wednesday afternoon we've asked Mr. Moonsparger and Mr. Tom.